from Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in Toothsome, Minneapolis. This is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are save system design and keeping secrets. And so, if everyone is ready, let's start. Speaking of keeping secrets. Lydia.
Yeah.
How did you not tell us that you were doing webinars?
I don't know. I'm on month 3 of a webinar a month. I'm doing it with Ellen on the 18th. And we still need to work on it. But yeah, the last 2 months I did webinars. I think it's just because it was part of my work talking and not this talking.
Sure. I get that. And sometimes it's just not a thing you want to bring up because you've
keeping your worlds a little separate.
Yeah, yeah.
It just escaped my brain. I don't know why I didn't think that you'd find it interesting. Because the first one, and these will be in the show notes, the first one is a sneak peek of a basically what I've been working on, the game project I've been working on with my current job at You'll Be Learning, the one that I took backfilled for Ellen before I backfilled for Nice Games Club, which we're releasing 2 days from now, which is nice. Yeah, it's called Category Quest. It's the 12th game in the suite of 11, now 12 games in
cool.
the training arcade.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like remember that episode about scoring systems that's been a pain in my butt? part of that from this project.
Ah.
So we did a let's play of I did a little let's play of that, did a little demonstration, but then also the game builder, which we had been planning to change for before I joined. And absolutely had to change for this game to function.
Yeah.
Also unveiling that and doing a little sneak peek of how you build the game and how
these are the tools for the clients for adding content for
yeah.
the group. Yeah.
Adding content, but also customizing the colors and the background all that fun stuff. And it's still very much a work in progress because it's a live product.
Yeah.
And then the one after that, the one I did this month or last month in May, was about the I actually got to meet up with the project manager from the escape room that you all interviewed me about.
Oh, yeah.
We'll
put that episode in the show notes, too.
Yeah.
If you missed it, I mean, shame on you, but go back and listen. It's good.
Yeah, it is very good. And so basically we were asked like, hey, do you want to do a webinar with the project manager, Sean? I was like, sure, why not? And so we kind of cast it as, how to make a game that builds empathy between clinicians and patients, because that was a major goal of ours. But then we cast it as a little bit of a postmortem in how to make a game and how you need to have a lot of empathy within teams and across teams in order to build something like this, because especially in a two team like or client vendor relationship like we have, you have the dev team, my side, the creative side, but then there's Sean's side, which was this SMEs, stakeholders, sponsors, and how on earth do you work? How on earth do you make a game? You need to have a lot of communication understanding for both sides. And so we got to do that. And it was really nice. Actually, like, kind of getting to debrief a little bit with a person who I considered a client but was a project manager. It was really, really nice. And I think it turned out pretty well. And also, there's a QR code at the end where you can play our game.
Yeah.
So you can actually play the game that I was tiptoeing around.
Yeah. That's exciting.
Yeah.
Launches are exciting.
I do not expect you to know anything about severe uncontrolled eosinophilic asthma. Maybe you'll learn something along the way, but it'll be okay. You don't have to understand all of it to do the puzzles, I hope. But if you're a pulmonologist or you know one, have them play it.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I'm excited to hear more about these webinars in the future, maybe. I guess I do understand the kind of keeping the division.
I truly did not mean it.
I know. It's all good.
I am taking a break in July.
Okay.
Marketing was like, hey, do you want to? I was like, I need a break, please. I'm tired.
Yeah. That's good. I'm glad they're giving you breaks.
Yeah.
But that's exciting. Speaking of exciting.
Oh, man. From where you're listening, dear listener, this will have been a couple of days ago, maybe last weekish. I'm so fried because of how hard I've been working on this project.
Yeah.
But and right now where we're sitting, it has not yet been publicly revealed. But the game I've been working on, Blippo Plus, has been announced. Now you may be like, I have heard of that because it's a Playdate game that is currently out. You can get it on Playdate. Mm-hmm. It's delivers weekly content. It is. I'm not even going to start describing it because, like,
it's really hard to. Yeah,
it is the wildest, most interesting thing. It's just like I think in another episode I will dig deeper into the content of it because oh man, it's one of those things where I think I've talked about this when I got this gig on the show to make the PC and Switch version of Blippo Plus, which was just how much I resonated with the project and the content and the creators.
Yeah.
Which is always nice when you get hired to do essentially like, can you just port this thing or program it? Like, you know, I've talked about, you know, projects I want to work on, and they need to be one that I'm not just invested in, but could have a little bit of a hand in and have a voice on, because otherwise I will go insane. Mm. And this project has been one where I've really been able to do that, but not just because the team is so good, but because the concept is so incredible.
Yeah.
It has this like core of empathy that I really, it's weird, right? Mm. But the thing you don't quite get from the trailers is just how much heart it has. Mm. And you don't really like, and that creeps up on you in a really fun way. I think a lot of the people looking at trailers are like, oh, it's got kind of an Adult Swim, Tim and Eric kind of vibe. It's like, yes, but minus the cynicism.
Yeah.
And that might be more than you'll hear from the other marketing on the project. Because it's kind of hard to explain without experiencing it.
Right.
Anyway, so that's gushing about the project outside of my involvement. But yes, I have been putting together this thing for the past year. And it's been really, really difficult. And I say that having where I'm sitting, not finished delivering to QA yet. And we have not announced a release date, but in the fall is what we're saying.
Okay.
It was announced last week-ish. Like I said, I'm just so fried. I don't remember exactly. We were looking at the calendar earlier today, like scheduling some things, and I've already forgotten all the details. But the PC gaming show for Summer Games Fest.
Ooh.
So like, you know, my company logo is on a trailer as part of an official quote unquote, you know, we still call it E3 showcase.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That's fun. I mean, you know, last year or years ago, a couple years ago now, when Dream Settler was announced, that was also during that time. And that was really exciting, but we just released that on our own as part of, you know, part of that. And it got picked up in a lot of the same in that whole press thing where everyone's angling for coverage.
Yeah.
And so that's just a fun career thing for me. But this is, you know, especially interesting. Panic, the publisher, they are the makers of the Playdate. Mm-hmm. And that explains my involvement, is I've sort of been in those circles. And the team there knew that I understood Playdate projects and that I also did PC and Switch games just from conversations I had with them at events and things. So I was the first person they thought of for this, which was really nice.
Oh, that's super
cool. That was very gratifying. Yeah. And it is so... It was really perfect because the Playdate version was designed first, mm-hmm. and this version was the PC Switch version. And we'll have all the links in the show notes for all the stuff. Now, there may be show notes in a previous episode that'll already have some of this stuff,
right?
Because we record a little bit in advance, some of this might be stuff you've already looked into. But if not, we will put all the details in there. The Playdate version was designed, and then the PC Switch version was we'll probably do that, but it was not really intended for it. It was kind of an afterthought, is not the right phrase because that's too diminishing of it. But it was like they just didn't think about it yet. And when they decided to do it, they're like, oh, we actually know someone who would be good for this because they could help get it over. Because the thing about a quote unquote port of a Playdate project is none of the code is usable.
Yeah.
So you do kind of have to build it over. It's very much like the old, you know, there was like two Aladdins in the 90s for SNES and Genesis. It's that kind of quote-unquote porting. It's the same game, but it is completely built from the ground up for this platform.
Right.
And that is, so it's helpful for me to be able to dig into the Playdate project and understand how one might do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it played to my unique strengths and also... A little bit of it was sort of like stars aligning, where like I was the first person they thought of, but like I don't think they knew how perfect I was for this project.
Yeah.
And so that was fun for all of us to discover together, because I didn't know how perfect I was for it either. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like, sure, that seems like I'm suited. I have the skill set required, but everything about it, technically, conceptually, all of it, so thrilled. Anyway.
Cool.
And I'm going to use this opportunity later in the episode to talk about, because I've had to keep this secret for so long, I'm going to talk more about that, but that is all of my raving at the top of the show about Blippo Plus for now. More to come.
Cool. Oh, mm-hmm. Very exciting stuff. Mm-hmm. I love hearing y'all's work. Speaking of work, this is my go-to transition for the day. Speaking of work, Lydia, you have a topic.
Yeah. So, I've been, while sometimes what I do is at work, if I brain need break because brain think too hard, I will throw on a GDC talk or I'll read a little bit. Haven't done that a bit. But one of the times when I was doing this brain reset, I was watching a GDC talk about cognitive accessibility for cognitive disabilities. Mm. And that is going to be in the show notes as well, already there. Building it into your games from the jump. And one of the things that was actually really surprising to me was one of the things that they talk a lot about, how if you build accessibility into a game, that is helpful for one, it's helpful for many, it's the cut curb effect, right? I know that very well with subtitles and closed captioning. I watch pretty much everything with subtitles. Just it helps a lot. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that they brought up was at will manual saving. I started thinking a lot about save systems and how interesting they were.
Yeah.
Part of it is also because, like, as a kid, one of the things that I very much appreciated my parents, what they did was, if I was playing a computer game and they wanted me to come out and do something, they were very good about understanding if I explained, like, I have to get to a save point and I think I know where it is, but it's going to take me a bit.
Yeah.
Because then I can save the game and then I can close it. They were pretty okay with it. If they weren't, then I don't remember them not being, and overwhelmingly they were chill about it. Mm-hmm. So thanks, Mom and Dad. But also just how many different types of save mechanics there are, and how that how you save is a very intentional choice these days.
Yeah.
So I say these days because, like, that was a, like, that is a hard thing to program from what I understand, and it just did not exist. And the closest, I mean, an honorable mention to one is level codes. I think I have a little bit of a soft spot for those. I think they're kind of fun. Mm-hmm. I think those are pretty neat, where you, like, you beat something and it feels like you've won something when you're like, I beat the code. I know how to jump forward.
Yeah.
Kind of in the same vein of, like, if you you get to finally fast travel someplace that you've been to a lot. It feels kind of like that.
Mm-hmm. I have, like, a fun aside about level codes, but you're, like, the sort of the passwords.
Yeah.
Essentially, right? So Metroid is really famous for that. And we think it's like, oh, because the design exceeded the reach of the technology.
Yeah.
We needed that. It's kind of the other way around, in that those early ones were because the Famicom disk system games and PC games that were ported to home consoles that could save the integer that it could store for a level. It was a very small amount of data, which is why the password works, because it can be just turned into a number or a single piece of data. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really a complicated thing. But then all those things came to NES or whatever, and then it was like, well, we can't just, this game is not designed to start over halfway through.
Right.
We need to have the, so this, that was the compromise to a system that was already built.
Oh, that's
rather
so
than
cool.
An invention necessarily, and there may have been parallel invention in that era, but rather than like an invention to solve that problem, because it was limited by the technology, so no one really thought to think past that.
Yeah.
But on other platforms you could, and then, you know, as things aligned.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So besides, I mean, we have the level codes, but then there's on-demand manual saving, which you can also think about in kind of two ways. There's exact moment in time. So think like Skyrim. It tells you, hey, you can't if there's enemies nearby. But then there's something like Stardew Valley where you can save at any point, but if you leave and come back, it'll take you to the beginning of that day, which is the closest checkpoint. Mm-hmm. There's limited manual saving. So, for example, you can only save in an overworld. You can only save outside of dungeons, but once you go inside, you can't save.
Yeah.
Auto-saving when changing locations or screens. So, again, in Skyrim, every time you enter or exit a building, that it triggers an auto-save file. Which is the bane of my existence on PS4, because then I have to delete so many save files in order to save again. And it's so clunky.
Yeah.
There's designated save points. So it's a glowing orb or a campfire or a typewriter, but also the level design of its location. So there's, like, you know, you could get a save point right outside the boss or the 5 minutes running up to the boss.
Mm-hmm.
So I believe that's pretty standard for Souls-likes, where the run-up, the lead-up to a boss is part of that experience.
Yeah, that's true.
Auto-save on close, so it just saves that. And then none, right? There's no save. Yeah. None.
You're Tetris, for instance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So saving as a cognitive accessibility mechanic, it was really interesting because they were talking about it in terms of how it can be helpful. It was specifically pulled from the person's experience with ADHD, mm-hmm. where it's like, you know, if I'm going into a cognitive heavy place and the last save point was 10 minutes before and I die or something, then I have to remember the 10 minute of puzzles beforehand, and I've already dumped that memory.
Right.
So I have to remember that, and then I get there, and then I have to prepare for the cognitive load again. But if I die again, then it, you know, that kind of thing. But then also the cut curb effect is, for example, like parents with small children, you know, you have to be up and away from the computer at any point, or up and away from the console at any point.
Yeah.
And it also, in the form of like allowing people to meet the game where they are in the moment. So like, I can't handle this right now, I'm going to go. And I can also imagine that being true for physical ability as well. Cause like I personally knit, I crochet, I cook, I sew, I play games. My hands are just going to get obliterated at some point. Mm. and so I can very much imagine a scenario where it's like, I am an old person with arthritis and I have to just stop and give my hands a break.
Yeah. Yeah.
Having to find a save point, which could be like 5 minutes away, is going to be a pain in the butt. Mm-hmm. But also, like, especially when you think about save points that are tied to objects. So the one that's really clear is like the typewriter in Resident Evil.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the campfires in Souls-likes. I think especially the typewriter. I think partly because it's a everyday object, and partly because it is like a little beacon of safety. But also you're still not safe because you're never safe in Resident Evil games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's something about the way that you choose your save method and how it integrates and sets the tone for your game.
Yeah, you can have a sort of narrative conceits that are sort of, it's like they crack the fourth wall a little bit very frequently.
Yeah.
But it's meant to communicate a gameplay thing, but also a story thing.
Yeah, and the frequency of saves, the ability of saves. I mean, Hades 2 does a really interesting thing, which I don't know if I want to spoil, but I'll say like, yeah, you have a pause menu, but you're also fighting the god of time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
How do you deal with that?
I know of that one.
Yes. how the interesting kind of pull between having something be accessible or having something be playable, convenient, somewhere along that spectrum. But then also, how do you flavor it, or how do you make interesting limitations to it? How do you limit that as a resource if it is important to the tone and setting of your game?
Yeah.
I think that there are extremely good arguments when it comes to things like trigger warnings, where those are not, for the people who need them, those are not in conflict with each other.
Yeah.
They are, in fact, hand in hand, allow people to be able to engage with the game and fully establish with that tone.
Yeah.
I would love to hear about how that could work with save mechanics.
Yeah.
Because I don't know. I don't think it is different, but it feels different.
Sure. I have thoughts on this.
Yes.
One of the things that I think is interesting about emulators that I think that games in general don't use is they have save states.
Right.
That are only temporary saves. Well, I think they're meant to be temporary saves. I guess you can use
them. It's like a clipboard.
Yeah, effectively. It's like, it's copy-save thing or copy-paste thing where you could save wherever at any point. But if you save again, it just removes that save and then you've moved on.
Mm-hmm.
So
you can't do save scumming, really.
You can't exactly do save scumming. I mean, I guess you can always save at a point and then go back to that point.
Yeah, so but
you can
kind of, like, if you're gonna save scun, it's a long con.
Yeah. That's something that the Switch has those N64 games and stuff. Yeah. You can use save states in that.
Yeah.
But that's not a thing that like is typically done in most video games, which I kind of think would serve particularly well for accessibility purposes, as well as not compromising a lot of the design of games. Mm-hmm. It compromises it.
Technically, it's extremely difficult because essentially those types of things, and for retro emulation, it just literally stores the RAM of the system it's emulating, which is tiny.
Right.
But if you were to do something that's as generic as that, you would need to store, system configurations are different, and it's a big amount of data.
Yeah, that's true.
You would also need
a lot of it's wasteful as well.
Yeah,
right? You would need to be able to tell at what point you were saving, because in the human dumps their human RAM after doing something scenario, being able to remember what the save actually was without having to load it and find out would be absolutely vital for that.
Right. Well, then the intention of this kind of thing is not so that people can like literally make a save at any point. Yeah. It's just so that like, oh, my kid is crying and I need to go deal with that. Or my stove is on fire. I don't know.
maybe because that's what's making the kid cry.
Yeah, I mean. But for, you know, for any reason, somebody can stop and then pick it back up in 5 minutes, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever.
Yeah. Well, you're looking for a pause button.
Yeah, you need a pause. Yeah, a pause button.
And you can take the tape out of the thing and put it on the shelf and it will stay in that spot.
Yeah.
That's what you're looking for, right?
Oh, yeah. That's the other save is you put your system in pause and then you just leave it running.
Right.
That's the other save system I forgot to mention.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think I have a kind of two minds about that, which is like if, you know, pizza it comes to the door and you got to go grab it or a phone call or something and, and you're not at a place that can reasonably save, you lose some progress.
Yeah.
Like that can be frustrating. And from an accessibility perspective, there are more scenarios under which that might occur.
Yes.
But speaking generally, I think the solution to that is to have a attitude about games, which is that that's not that important. Right. But that's hard to do. It's it's hard to design into a system to not frustrate players when those moments happen. And also just psychologically, even at the lowest stakes kind of thing, you can certainly get into a position where it will frustrate you more than is sort of reasonable.
Well,
I think that maybe what you're circling around is that if you're going to have that limitation, then you have to have more care with how that limitation, or if you're going to make it a resource, you're going to have more care with how you put that resource into your game. So for example, like if you're going to have designated save points, having more of them, having them in places that are distinctly safe and stay safe. So like maybe there is always, I think that's actually like there are safe rooms, right?
Yeah.
You can find a safe room, it is designated and you always know that like no monsters are going to be there. So that way, basically, you know, you can't make the resource, You can't force them to have to access a resource and make it extremely limited, because then it goes into artificial frustration and not tone.
Right. And that's part of the thing too, is like some of the way that safe building works is it's like a or the system anyways can be like a difficulty setting sort of thing, or a world building situation where like you put the, like Dark Souls in particular, like they have certain campsites in every place. You got to make it to the next campsite. And typically they're not like that far away, but you got to deal with all of these enemies in the process. And so that's built into the core of the design so that like you get better at dealing with this stretch of level so that you can get to this next save point. And then you start learning the next part of the level.
I mean, even just like if you have a map and it's and not all of it's filled, but you see the save points, like you like the save points are always in a fog of war, because that's one of the things that's hard. I think what's good is when you have enough knowledge of the game, then you can start to like allocate your spoons for, okay, I only have this much time, I only have this much brain, or this much energy. I could try going forward, or I can go back and I can hit the save point and I will hopefully remember where to go. If you know where how far you need to go, then that's really, really helpful, because then you can accurately make that conversion for yourself.
Yeah.
Whereas, I mean, I think there's a lot of times where you just kind of keep going forward and you're like, am I going to hit a save? Where is the next save? Am I going to die before this next save? Do I turn back now? Kind of sounding like your car adventure.
And that could be part of the game, right? Like, that could be an important aspect of the game. And that's part of sort of what Dark Souls, that experience is. You don't necessarily know where the campsite is.
Yeah.
You trust that there is one eventually. But you don't know where it's going to be.
If that's going to be the vibe, you have to establish it early and establish it firmly that this is not a fluke. This is how it is. Like, this is a truth of the world.
Right.
Otherwise, like, that could be an avenue for having a limited save resource, but sprinkled around the map.
And truthfully, like that is that way of designing a save system is not accessible in the ways that this talk you're talking about would like games to be. And so, like that is like a compromise, I guess. Maybe compromise isn't the right word, but like that's a decision that they made.
Trade off.
Yeah. I'm trying not to diminish the accessibility.
No, I mean, that's the thing is
by saying compromise.
I think that like it is something that is very hard to wrap your head around why something wouldn't be quote unquote ruined by making it more accessible.
Yeah.
And I think that I've heard better and better explanations and shorter and shorter, more elegant explanations, which I think has helped me change my own perspective.
Yeah.
And so I'm hoping that that can keep going. It's now going to be very interesting to see those conversations and those explanations broadened into other mechanics and see how people are able to creatively change that, because, you know, I don't know. It's just going to be how the game saves, how you will leave it, and how it will come back is such an integral part of the gameplay experience. Because when you are someone who leaves and comes back to a game, it's not like an arcade, I guess.
Yeah.
That it'll be really interesting to see how it changes and how it grows over time, and also how it stays the same. I don't know. It just really made me think about it. Just such a quote unquote simple or integral part of playing a game can itself have so many varieties.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I sometimes feel like games default to certain decisions because other games have done it in the past, or like technology is advanced enough so that they don't have to do, you know, passcodes, for instance.
Yeah.
But it might serve your game better if you do something that might feel archaic at the time.
Yeah.
I think that like Resident Evil works because like they have those save rooms, they have the safety places where you can do the save, but they also limit how many times you can save. So like you have to really be, because it's a part of the resource management aspect of Resident Evil,
right?
That is important to that how that game works, I assume.
you wouldn't know.
Yeah. So I think that like it serves that game. In the newer Resident Evils, actually I do know this because I watched the speedruns. The newer Resident Evils do have that the same saving mechanics that the older Resident Evils did, including the remakes. And you know, they've modernized a lot of the things about Resident Evil, but they ported that effectively over.
Right, because you could change it or update it, but then it becomes more of a design choice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, because how you interact with those systems. And some games are very feather light, like auto saves always, or some are like manual saves only, and it is up to player to manage sort of apart from the game, but part of the experience of playing the game.
Yeah.
But then there's most games are in the middle where it's like the save systems are part of the gameplay.
Yeah.
But I think maybe designers don't always understand how much it is a part of the gameplay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It ticks a box and it works and it makes sense and it doesn't break anything or get in the way of anything. Great. But like there's opportunities that I think are lost, right? To actually make that engaging or support your design pillars, you know, rather than just like solve your design problem.
Yeah, yeah. And ultimately, like, you know, the way that you save can affect how you approach the game. If you can save whenever you want, then the threats can be effectively eliminated because before you get this last fatal hit, you can just save and then you know it's happening and dodge or something like that. Like, I mean, Skyrim is famous for that kind of stuff, right? I guess you can also screw yourself over because you can save right before you fall into a pit.
Yeah.
So you got to be careful about it, I suppose. But like, it can affect how a player approaches and experiences the game. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's basically a lot of the stuff that you've been saying, Lydia. So, you know, it requires a lot of consideration. And yeah, I'm curious to see how developers improve upon their designs of save systems in the future.
And also combine save systems too.
Yeah.
Like, Persona 5 has, I think, at-will saving, but then there are safe rooms within dungeons, and you can only fast travel to the exit or to other safe rooms from those safe rooms.
Okay.
And you can save there, right?
Yeah.
But, like, and so it takes that whole idea of a safe room and it gives some limited mechanics to it, but then you still have the ability to save often, which is good, because if you accidentally die in a Persona game and you forgot to save 45 minutes ago and you realize you're 3 days early after school,
Yeah. I mean, not having played that game, that sounds a little bit like a mashup of things that solve different problems rather than one single elegant system. But I think it shows that a save system where you have to go to a place or checkpoints mm-hmm. also serves a very important like pacing mechanic.
Right.
Apart from its ability to actually save your game.
I think it's more that they're leaning on the idea, the preconceived understandings of safe rooms.
Yeah.
As like, this is a place I am safe and I can save. And
yeah. Oh, exactly. That's exactly what I mean. So it's not actually that important that you can save there. It's more just about because you can save anytime.
Yeah.
And there's generous auto saving or whatever. But like that system is still there for all of its other benefits.
Yeah.
Right. And then the language is that you should expect also to save there. So why not?
Yeah.
Again, having not played that game. But I think that pacing mechanic is important because games are broadly like cinematic, big games are broadly a lot easier to play.
Yeah.
They're essentially meant to just get you through the experience and enjoy it and feel it in a way rather than like the same level over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're Dark Souls, there's obviously plenty out there.
Yeah.
But because of that, those checkpoints also become opportunities to stop playing.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's true.
And when you can, put your system to sleep.
Yeah.
Unless you're juggling three or four games on your console or your PC. Well, on your PC, you've been doing this elsewise. But all the consoles anyway now have, you can just turn it off and turn it back on. You don't need save systems.
That's true.
Technically, as long as you don't close the game, right?
Yeah.
And so, but those systems are still really important for you to decide, like, now I'm done playing.
Yeah.
Right? And so as a designer, you have to be sort of really deliberate about that. Like in Widget Satchel, because you can't die in that game, the checkpoints are only there for you to choose to go back to.
Yes.
Or when you quit, that's where they load from.
Right.
You don't respawn there necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need to be placed at spots where that were reasonable to say, like, this is about as much gameplay as we'd expect a player to get. And then that plus the next section might be too much to ask them to do because we're not letting them die, which was an opportunity to quit.
Yeah.
Right? I think you have to be sort of really deliberate about how that interacts with all the other ways the game experiences. But I think, the main one is, like, when do you put your controller down?
Yeah.
Right?
All right, listeners. My birthday is coming up. I'm not going to tell you when it is because it's none of your business. But
you need to know it's coming.
Yes. And I would like...
And you've got a gift registry open?
In fact, I do. Please buy me a nice Games Club pillow because I don't own one yet. I have a t-shirt. They're nice and soft. They're really comfortable. But I don't have the pillow.
Yeah.
So, I'm not going to give you my address either. So, I'm realizing that this doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, what you could do is you could just buy it for yourself.
Yes.
On behalf of Steven.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that would be a good gift for him as well.
I would feel really nice if you got yourself a gift. Because then you feel good, and I'm helping you feel good by you purchasing one of our merchandise.
Well, and also, Steven, what is the best gift, if not money? And by buying our merch, you help fund the podcast.
That's
like
true.
Like buying microphone covers.
As someone who got married once, yes, money is the best gift.
I believe that. You can go to nicegames.club/merch, buy yourself a t-shirt. If you haven't bought one for yourself yet, why haven't you done that? They're so comfortable. You can buy yourself a pillow. Please do that so that I can see you holding a pillow. That would be great.
Yes, send in images.
Please, no fondue pots, no slow cookers.
No.
Have enough, chargers for your plates.
Yeah. Don't need any of that. Just get yourself a pillow. You can also buy Glom at this site, which is a fun game that you probably own by now. But if you don't, go purchase that. You can go to nicegames.club/merch.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting radio exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Mark, what rant you got set up for us?
Okay, let me just wind up for this a little bit. Okay, so I talked at the top of the show about Blippo Plus.
Yes.
Which, just saying it out loud, is so weird. Because I've been keeping it as a secret. And like,
right.
I'm phrasing that, I could call this topic non-disclosure agreements, right? Because that is what I'm going to be talking about.
Okay.
Is sort of professional secrets.
Yeah.
But I want to call it keeping secrets just to, so people understand how silly it is. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, and how I think we have a, it's a problem in our industry because it serves a real purpose, right?
Yes.
And I'm going to talk about Blippo Plus particularly, but also about generally like how game projects work. Like when you sign an NDA or when you ask somebody to sign an NDA, mm-hmm. a lot of times you get this boilerplate language and people don't really interrogate what it is you're doing or why.
Yeah.
And so, and I have a lot of experience in this area. Mm-hmm. So, like most projects that I've worked on, either as a contractor or as you know, sort of a hired partner, I signed an NDA for Blippo Plus in my contract. But it was basically just don't reveal publicly anything we haven't revealed publicly.
Yeah.
Right? That was sort of the language. And that's essentially the thing that makes a lot of sense, right? Mm-hmm. Because in the case of Blippo Plus, the marketing for it was very secretive.
Right.
And so that was really valuable, right? We didn't announce it really early and have a forum set up and try to hype it. It was meant to be a surprise.
You're being intentional about it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so so that's important for me to clear up right away that like it was the correct attitude for this project.
Right.
And I had no part in designing the marketing or anything. Like I was in some of those meetings early on, but like that just to sort of contribute, not design any of the how this was going to be presented to people. Mm-hmm. Definitely not my area. And so that's another thing. It's like knowing where your place is and that sort of thing. But that's my most recent experience with this. And so sort of through that lens, I want to talk about how much I hate NDAs in the sense that how they're presented and how they get abused and how they work in light of the fact that the secret I had kept on Blippo Plus was the 100% right thing to do.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right. And so I think that's important to understand the distinction because it's really easy to complain about a lot of things in our field without understanding that it got that way. Because there was an intention behind it that either got out of hand or people weren't paying attention to it or they lost the plot, right? Yeah. And that is definitely what happened on this. So general thoughts on NDAs as a contractual matter, like a contract you sign. Conceptually, I have no respect for an NDA, like absolutely none. Like if you want me to legally agree to keep a secret, like that is the silliest friggin' thing. Like it's utterly laughable.
Sure.
In most industries, particularly in the entertainment industries.
Yeah.
If I do sign one, mm-hmm. I will keep your secrets.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm a rule follower. Like I'm not gonna break the rules because I don't think like if I signed it,
you gave them your words
right
to do it. Yeah.
I have overcome my frustration or silliness.
Yeah.
Which means that the ones I do sign are the ones where I agree with the point of it.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
I have signed a lot of these for various projects.
Sure.
And most of the time, I sign them for projects I have no interest in telling anybody about.
Yeah.
Right. When I was doing a lot of video work, or stuff for like building like website games for General Mills or doing like video spots for Target or whatever. Like because I would get some graphics or something or something to use, and those were company secrets. And
yeah.
mm-hmm. I have no respect for this as a secret.
Yeah.
But I also have no interest in revealing it, right?
Yeah.
When I worked at an ad firm that did a bunch of work for Best Buy, we would get tons of information about the latest Samsung phones.
Mm-hmm.
And they were so paranoid about that, where they put us in like an air-gapped room to work on the like, that's goodness. How that's yeah. how paranoid they were about it. Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't even sign an NDA for that work.
Yeah.
So it's just, I could have told anybody about what I was doing. Like, I mean, I would have gotten fired, but like, but I had, I mean, zero respect at all for the notion of to keep a secret of what the Samsung Galaxy S14 looks like.
Sure.
Like, I don't, it's just not important to me.
Yeah.
But because of that, I also am like, I'm not a threat to that secret.
Yeah.
I'm happy to keep it for you. Don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important thing about it that is very hard, because when you sign an NDA, it has a really harsh chilling effect.
Yeah.
You don't know what is a secret. And it's, those things are incredibly broad.
Right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times in the contracts, there's liability penalties assigned to it, which in practice never, ever happen. I have not heard of a single person in this industry or any industry I've ever worked in
that
has ever gotten sued for revealing something they shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
But on the flip side of that, these things are violated all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, in a way that doesn't matter, mm-hmm. right? You know, you're in a job interview and like, what are you working on? Well, I'm under an NDA, but here's all the details.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It happens, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's because no one really cares,
mm-hmm.
but you sign these things and they have the force of contract law. Like, you could go to court and, you know, which isn't to say that a judge wouldn't look at it and say, this is silly, but it is ridiculous. It's all very ridiculous.
Mm.
But again, if it's a secret you don't care, then it's like, fine, agree to keep the secret. But I think there are important things that when you are given an NDA, there's two things I think are really important that you should actually negotiate.
Okay.
One is, do not agree to accept any more liability that is reasonable.
Okay.
Boilerplate language on these contracts, sometimes they will include things like, you know, you agree that these secrets are so valuable that if they were revealed, it would cause undue damage to this company and you would be liable for that. Like, get that stuff crossed out of that contract.
Yeah.
One, the person asking you to sign it isn't going to fight you back because they know how silly that is.
Mm.
But two, that is very much a cover your ass kind of clause, but it is just not the reality. And I think that I think more people should really stand up to clauses like that.
Yeah.
Like, perfectly happy to accept any punishment for revealing a secret. Like, you want to fire me? You want, you know, you want to like not use my work? You want to, whatever other avenues are available? Like, fine, that's fair, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I agree to do a thing and then say I didn't. Like, you know, I shouldn't get away with it.
Yeah.
But like, to say that it would cause additional damages, which in a contract means that when a judge looks at that, they say, well, you agreed that this would, that you would, that is okay to assess damages on you. So
now
how these things hold up in court, very untested, because they are very ridiculous.
Yeah.
But like, you shouldn't be signing that, even if it's for something you don't care about.
Okay.
Because that is, I don't know, I feel very strongly about that.
Sure.
And also that language is really hard to recognize. You know, talk to a lawyer if you can, or get familiar with it, you know, from other examples, and then talk to the person signing, because it's all about trust, right?
Yeah.
Like you wouldn't, you know, the trust between people is bigger than the contract anyway.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's important, to, I don't know, I'm just trying to drill down how important it is that like, you shouldn't really be signing things you don't actually agree with.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I mean, that's kind of the intention. My understanding of how NDAs are built is that's the intention, is that you want to trust somebody with this information so that they can help you with it, or because you want to tell them it, or whatever, for whatever reason.
You want to reveal it to somebody, but not everybody.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you want to tell this person about this thing, and you don't want that secret to be splayed upon on the news.
Yep.
It's also important to know if this is coming from the person you are talking to, or if it is coming from people behind the person who you're talking to.
Yeah. True. Yeah.
Because especially when we're working with client work, for example, there have been times where one of my producers was working on something that the client had a very strict NDA, so he actually couldn't talk about what he was talking about. It would just be like blocked out, and like, oh, I have a meeting with a client and I can't move it.
Yeah.
And that's all he could really say.
Yes. It creates a lot of practical problems.
Right. And that's because, you know, or there's other proprietary stuff where it's not the person you're working with, but it's a sponsor behind them, or it's another entity, right?
Yeah.
And so I think as part of establishing a trust, it's good to know where it's coming from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because then that also, that establishes opens up the conversation, and it helps us to explain why it can or cannot be removed, how it could be changed, and mm-hmm. also so that way you are on even footing information wise with the person you're talking to.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Right.
Yes. Yes. So the other thing you should look out for when mm-hmm. you're signing these things is, and this is exceedingly common, and this speaks a little bit to who is presenting it, because a lot of times who is presenting it is a lawyer who doesn't know anything about the situation, which yeah. is like, this is the boilerplate, mm-hmm. and their interest is protecting their client in every way, so they're just as broad as they possibly can be.
Right.
Because mm-hmm. there's no downside to just making it worse for the person you're making sign it, you know, other than the fact that you're engaging in perpetuating this ridiculous thing, but no one really cares about them. They should, but anyway. But the other thing that is part of that is very frequently you get clauses that say, like, this confidentiality will survive the termination of this agreement, which means that you agree that even if the project fails or the project is complete and information is public now, everything you learned is now whatever, and the contract is no longer enforced, it's done in every possible way.
Yeah.
You still need to keep these secrets to your grave.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. I would call that a crime.
Mm.
Like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like putting, but it is really common in these documents to ask somebody to say, like, hey, you know, I'm going to hire you for this thing, and don't share any of the bitmaps that I'm sending you to put together. And also, until the day you die, you cannot reveal any of my character designs.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, I mean, it's so laughable.
Yeah.
And it's laughable to the point where people just say whatever and they sign it. Like, I bet there are people listening who don't understand how many secrets they are legally required to keep until they die.
I know, that's me. Yeah. I don't know.
And, and now, again, these are not generally legally enforceable. Like, they've been not well tested.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's a silly topic. People don't treat it seriously.
Right.
You know, trust conquers all in this area, right? But actually agreeing to keep a secret to your grave is, like, I mean, that is the worst. I don't know. I have a huge moral problem with that. And I will, in every contract I sign, I will always, like, I will quit a project over something like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't care how much I want to work on it. Like, I will, that's going to be a deal breaker, because it's like, that's a moral problem. Mm. Like, that even though it doesn't matter. You know, so as a practical matter, if you've signed one, you don't have to worry. Because, like, even if it's, again, it's not, these things are not real in a sense. But, like, I want to encourage more and more people to understand how stupid some of these clauses are.
Sure.
Because that should not mean anything about, like, not wanting to keep a secret, like, or not, you know, or that you shouldn't sign a thing that makes sense.
That's not what you're talking about. You're talking about specifically the documents of NDAs.
And especially if there's, like, sensitive information, sometimes an NDA is really important to codify an agreement that exists already.
Yes.
Very frequently, what will happen is that you just sort of agree that it's in everyone's interest to keep the secret.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often good enough for people, mm-hmm. right? And then an NDA is supposed to essentially codify that. So in the instance there's ever a conflict, which is really what contracts are about, you know, let's just make sure we have it written down so there's no mistaking it.
Yeah.
That is important, but very often it becomes a very one-sided thing.
Yeah.
And so on a side topic for this, like, non-compete agreements, clauses tend to be paired with these when you get boilerplate language.
Yeah.
Like you can't do this work for someone else, or anything you learned on this project, you can't, like, compete with us on it.
Mm-hmm.
Cut all that out. One, it's mostly illegal now in many states. So, you know, maybe you don't have to worry if you've previously signed one like this. And also, no one checks on these things. It's not... But, like, going back to the work I was doing in film and commercial marketing and stuff like that, these things were all the time. You'd see these clauses, and they just they're all afraid of everyone poaching each other. Mm. We don't really have that problem in the game industry as much.
Yeah,
AAA studios complain about it sometimes, but mostly in the context of crediting.
Mm.
They don't want to, like, publish their full list of credits because they don't want a list of poachable talent, like. You know, which is, that's ridiculous.
Also silly.
But you have this kind of attitudes about imposing burdens on someone for the, you know, in exchange for letting them work on your project.
Yeah.
Which is just that's a very weird backwards way to treat that relationship. Anyway, so secrets are worth keeping in a lot of sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and, you know, that's where, why this is, I think, important to talk about in the context of Blippo, which is something that, like, frustrated me that I couldn't talk about my involvement, but, like, it was correct, right? It was the right thing for this project and the way it was done. And it was really very much about the marketing, right?
Right.
Like, even the creative leads were not part of the reveal, mm-hmm. right? Or the initial reveal in last winter. It was meant to be this thing that came out of nowhere until it was surprise released on Playdate. And where we're sitting now, it's still the first week of content on Playdate. It's out on Playdate. And then in a couple of days from where we're sitting, the second week will come out. And then it will be revealed who worked on it. And it will be revealed that there is a second week, which isn't technically been revealed yet. People are figuring it out that there'll be more content.
Sure.
And then a few days after that is when we're revealing the color version on PC and Switch. That's when my involvement will be announced.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that will be more traditional press release kind of thing. But for the past couple of months, and especially in this last week when it was surprise released as part of season 2 on Playdate, it was really meant to be just this thing that came from outer space.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that is really important to the experience of it.
Right.
And the revelation of it in the world. And so that was a secret worth keeping.
Mm-hmm.
Like, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now for me on the show, it was important when I was talking about what I was working on. So, you know, I would talk vaguely about this FMV game I'm working on. Right. I try to toe the line so I could at least have some.
You could bring up topics related to it, yeah.
But it was important that I didn't give enough hints for anyone to figure it out.
Yeah.
Because that was essentially the same as revealing it,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. Like, that's the other thing about NDAs is, like, if you are on the other side of that trying to technically say, well, I'm not going to say what it is, but here are all the clues for you to figure it out, that's just you telling someone.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
like, it's, thing. You know, the law isn't always about what literally happens. It's about what you intend to happen.
Yeah.
Like, I think people don't quite understand that. And so that's definitely an example of that. So I tried to avoid that as much as I could. If you had a hint that that's what I was working on, like, if you could piece together that I had a relationship with the Playdate community, like, I mean, then that's a failure of my part. Mm. If any listeners could have guessed that I was involved with that. I don't think anybody in the community did. I did have to actually pull back my involvement in the Playdate community a little bit because I was like, I didn't want to, like, as they were all talking about it,
accidentally blurt.
Because I also didn't want to misrepresent myself.
Yeah.
That's another thing that's very burdensome in, especially in games, is like, you do kind of have to, in those contexts that's public, you kind of have to, like, you shouldn't lie to people.
Right.
You know, if you can avoid it.
Yeah.
Now, these are, like, harmless lies. So, you know, just saying, like, it's like, oh, yeah, interesting. What's that all about?
Mm.
Like, even for me, that's a problem I have, right?
Sure.
I'm not going to go that route. Now, in the past week or so, as people have been hinting about what's to come with this project, I have said things that are technically when people will go back when they find out I'm involved. I mean, just little tiny things.
Yeah.
People
may
not even notice that.
Yeah.
That's been kind of a fun treat. That we've all sort of on the team have sort of encouraged each other to do a little bit for our own amusement.
Sure.
anyways, so the spirit of these things are often good, and when you sign a contract, it sometimes it's not, even if you do have full trust, sometimes you do want to just write it down.
Yeah.
And as long as you don't have any of those, like, terrible clauses, you're all right. And the key thing about it, from my perspective on Blippo, and a lot of times when you are on a project, even if you're really heavily involved. Or, you know, a creative lead, if you're not the owner of the sort of IP,
mm-hmm.
like, it's, the thing is that they're not your secrets to share, right?
Yeah.
And that goes back to the sort of marketing angle. But even separate from the marketing, like, it is important to, you have to sort of acquiesce to, like, well, and this is why you don't want to do any of the sort of, like, hinting. You don't want to feel shackled. You want to support the intention of the person who's deciding when that information comes out. That can make you feel a lot better about being under an NDA, is when you believe in it, right? And that's sort of important. If you sign one under duress, then you probably shouldn't be working on that project.
No, you shouldn't sign a contract under duress, period.
Well, yes. I mean, maybe duress is too strong a word.
But I mean, ultimately, it's all about trust. So, like, if you don't trust the person you're signing this agreement with, or the group, or a company, or whatever.
Yeah.
Then, like, that's a problem.
Right. So, in the other big project that I'm still working on, Dream Settler.
Yes.
For a long time on the show, I would talk about, I'm working on this thing,
mm-hmm.
and then I would say, like, oh, I'm working on it's follow up to Hypnospace Outlaw.
Yeah.
And that you could figure out that was the sequel to Hypnospace Outlaw, right?
Right.
But I didn't sign an NDA on that project, and that was not a secret that we were trying to keep.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't say the name of the title. I didn't talk about the sort of details that we were talking about as a team.
Yeah.
And I'm much more heavily involved as a creative lead on that project.
Right.
And so some of these are my secrets to keep.
Mm.
But that was important for me to we did have a plan when we did the trailer a few years ago. So I calibrated how I could describe it without shackling myself any further than necessary. And all of that was in the absence of any legal contract related to it. Mm-hmm. When you think about how you approach these things, always make sure you, like, your intention and your attitude should really line up with what the contract is.
Yeah.
Almost never is that the case, unfortunately. But what's kind of all right about it, or at least in a practical sense, is that generally everyone involved just treats it like the attitude that they all share. Mm. And then the legal contract just goes in a drawer somewhere. Mm-hmm. That frustrates me greatly because I think enumeration is really important, especially when conflict arises. You find out that no one was treating the spirit of the thing correctly.
Yeah. But
then suddenly you're fighting over what the contract says.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And that is just a weird position to be in if you ever are.
Yeah.
So avoiding that if you can. And of course, I am willing to be annoying about it when I'm working with people doing contracts. That's kind of, that can have a cost,
mm-hmm.
right? When it could just be like, whatever, just sign it and move on, it's fine. Like, that is kind of how these things have gotten the way they've gotten. But hopefully people will join me in like caring about this stuff a little bit. I think the last thing, that sort of area I want to talk about is the sort of reality of the fact that these things get broken all the time. So technically, where we're sitting here recording this episode, it's not been announced yet.
Right.
Like, I'm telling the two of you, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And this is essentially, now, so there's not microphones here. This would be what's called friend DA.
Yeah.
Right? Where you can say, like, well, I'm under contract, but like, well, who are you going to tell? Right? Now, you can have, there's a lot of times you have language in these things about if you are, because I sign all of my contracts as my company.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times those languages will have, well, if I have contractors, I can read them in,
yeah.
use spy language.
Right. Sure.
But then they are then also under it. So I need to be, I'm responsible for their disclosure. So if they reveal, I'm on the hook.
So
or, yeah. Or I would need to, well, no, not because you're not my contract.
Oh, well, I guess that's true.
No, we're not getting paid.
Right.
Right, I forgot.
Right. I mean, I am responsible because I told you.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But if I hired you to help me,
mm-hmm.
And then you blabbed and you didn't sign anything with me,
yeah.
you would be fine.
Oh, I guess. Okay.
Because you didn't sign anything.
I guess that's true.
You would just get fired. But like,
yeah.
but I would be on the hook because I'm the one assigned to
it. Before you even got hired, Stephen, what's going on?
No.
So this is a lot of times a language, and this is pretty good language in these things, boilerplate, which is just to say like, you're responsible for your, but if you need to read someone in, then you're still responsible for that information. And then you can do your own NDAs with those people if you want
to.
But that's your problem.
Yeah.
Right? And that's pretty boilerplate as well. But the thing about friend DA is it's incredibly common. And it is just like, it is essentially technically a violation of these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Like even us doing this now, whereas when listeners hear this, but that's why it's really valuable in these contracts where possible.
Yeah.
Now, this is not common.
Uh-huh.
But where possible, if you can negotiate it to say, public revelations, right? So if you tell your cousin and your cousin posts on, Blue Sky,
mm-hmm.
then that's public and you're on the hook.
Yeah.
But if you tell your parents what you're working on, because you will hear stories from people saying, I couldn't even tell my family what I was working on. And that's, in AAA, that's very common. And what that is, that's the chilling effect, right?
Yeah.
But you should hope that your contract, if you can negotiate it, is make sure that it doesn't ruin your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That you could... You can talk to people. You can vent to your spouse. You can show your kids what you're working on. You know what I mean? Like that's the kind of thing that is part of living your life in a way that like, especially it's the games industry. Like these are not nuclear secrets, right?
Yeah.
And this is where the NDAs that I've signed with platform holders. So like I'm a licensed Nintendo developer, so I have access to Nintendo's SDK, which includes even within the code, the confidentiality things. It's just a reminder. This is all secret. These are not secrets worth keeping, but I have to keep them because I signed a thing and I have to respect what I've signed, even if I have no respect for the concept behind it, right? And friend DA is one of those things where it is just so common, you just tell people around you, but a lot of times the explicit language of your contract will prevent that, which is why I think it's more important that people actually negotiate it for real and not just sign the boilerplate.
Mm-hmm.
And because you just have this burden of the legal language in front of you, if you sort of care about it, one of the things that I found really funny in a contract I have signed is the thing says treat these secret like it was actually like an overriding clause. It's like you should treat these secrets like you would treat your own secrets.
Mm.
And I was like, well, that's great. That's a get out of jail card for me.
Yeah.
Woo.
Like I have no respect for my own secrets. What do I care about yours?
Sure.
You know. Of course. You know. The intent of that is not that. There's an implicit assumption that everyone involved would have the same attitude.
Yeah.
And I find that really funny. And that's the thing about these things that are so fuzzy. It's like it's very defined legal language that has contextual meaning in the sense that it's repeated uses of the same boilerplate. So you can't parse it with a comb and say this technically doesn't mean that because everyone understood to mean this.
Right.
But this is definitely an example where literally that's actually just like a loophole, which is sort of wild. It's why this whole thing is silly, and I don't respect it as a topic, right? Mm-hmm. So it's just important to sort of try to keep sane when you're under these things. Only sign the things that make sense to you. And it's certainly not fun if you have a game development podcast and you're under NDAs to talk about that you can't talk about the game development you're working on. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, for me, I was working on two projects at the same time, so that was great, I guess.
Yeah.
For me. But most of you will not be in that position. So as long as you can tell your husband or whoever in your life, you don't have to keep secrets. You don't have to hide files on your desk from the people standing around you.
Yeah.
If you can find a way to not have to do that, you can live under an NDA no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully this has given you some context, because you'll be faced with this and you'll be like, what does this mean? And the person giving it to you is not going to be able to explain what it means.
Yeah.
Because the person giving it to you didn't write it. And it's the boilerplate. And I think the more literacy we have on this, the better.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Questions? No? All right. Let's get the hell out of this episode.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you one whole week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello.
So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.